This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 19 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. Hope you're enjoying the series so far. If you are, spread the word, tell your friends. You know how to do that by now. I don't need to remind you. You're probably up on all of the technologies more than me anyway. This week's guest is an absolute legend of a sports writer. So Sam Farmer from the Los Angeles Times has covered the NFL for 25 years. He's a Hall of Fame writer. His work has been recognized in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And he's just one of the great storytellers of the NFL. I've got to know Sam quite well over the last couple of years. He came over and covered some London games. We got together at the Super Bowl. And he is one of my favorites. So one question I get asked more than most is how I got into covering the NFL as a journalist. And I've even answered that question in our mailbag on this podcast. So I wanted to ask that question to Sam. What was his route to the NFL? And like most answers to that question, it was an unconventional journey.
Well, Neil, I went to college thinking I wanted to be a doctor. You know, I played football in high school and might have been the worst player in the state of California. but I was obsessed with football and, you know, the NFL in particular. And I was a Washington Redskins fan, so much so that I snuck into the Super Bowl when they played the Dolphins in 1983 at the Rose Bowl.
Wow. John Riggins going off.
Yes. And I pretended to be a Servomation concessionaire, a worker. I had a friend. There were four of us, and we got in line with. And it was early in the morning. It was probably 9 or 10 a.m. with the game starting at 3 p.m. because it was a West Coast game. I got queued up, as you'd say, with the people who sell sodas and beers and hot dogs and everything. And I was with my friends, John and Scott and Ron. And we went in a single file line into the stadium, and I secretly had a John Riggins jersey underneath my white button-down Oxford shirt, and I had, you know, brown dress pants. I was in the attire because I had a friend who had worked there before at college football games and knew what to wear to look like one of these employees. And then we decided to peel off into two groups. So Ron and I then peeled off the single file line and went and hid in a bathroom. And I thought, well, I was in the bathroom for about 10 minutes and I thought, I can't do this until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I took off my shirt and stuffed it in. It was my dad's white shirt, took it off, stuffed it in the rafters of the Rose Bowl bathroom. I might be able to find it still up there. This was, I don't know how many years ago, 37 years ago. And then Ron and I sort of milled around the outside of the Rose Bowl, inside the gates, but outside the Rose Bowl, trying to waste time until fans were allowed into the game. And so we found a UPI photographer who was setting up his shop, and I spun some yarn about my dad was a concessionaire and we were just helping him set up, and we friended this guy and he said, why don't you watch my equipment? So we sat there and watched a bunch of camera equipment as the day went by. Now, and I thought those poor suckers, John and Scott, had been kicked out. I thought there's no way they could have survived. Somebody'd have to find out that they were gypsies in the palace. And I looked across the field, and you could see this line of very, even from a distance, you could tell they were glamorous looking women filing into the stadium. And right in the middle were John and Scott walking with this line of women. And the announcer was testing the PA system, said, Miami Dolphins cheerleaders, can you hear me? And they all jumped up and down, including John and Scott jumping up and down in the middle of the Miami Dolphins cheerleaders. So they were the two guys who had better gigs than we did. We suddenly felt job envy. But anyway, I snuck into that Super Bowl and wanted to be a doctor coming out of high school, and took my first few chemistry classes in college and decided that would require more studying than I had hoped for in college. And so I tried my hand at sports writing and I loved it. And that's a long-winded way of saying, how did I get to be an NFL writer? Well, once I started sports writing, I covered high schools and small colleges, then came to Seattle. That was in Los Angeles at a very low level, and then went to Seattle where I was covered the University of Washington football program, which mm-hmm. did very well, won a national championship. I wound up writing a book on that University of Washington football team about their tumultuous ride, turbulent ride from national champions to being put on probation. And then covered the NBA for a couple of years. And then when the Raiders moved from Los Angeles to San Jose, I got a job cover for the San Jose Mercury News, which was a bigger paper covering the Raiders. So
fantastic.
My NFL career started with a 5-year sentence covering the Raiders.
I really enjoy the Super Bowl story because, 1992, summer of 1992, so I was 20, and I'd only really started doing a little bit of NFL reporting, but only sort of freelance. Didn't have any full-time gigs. I donned an orange vest and got in and pretended to be a steward, a security guard, at Crystal Palace, and got to watch Joe Montana working out ahead of the American Bowl. So I kind of,
that is fantastic.
I've been, yes, where you've been, not quite bold enough to pull it off at a Super Bowl. You couldn't do that now at the Super Bowl, could you?
No, do you remember not.
Do you remember your first NFL interview? So mine was Doug Marrone. He was a center for the London Monarchs in 1991. And I still tell Coach Marrone when I see him that he was my first ever NFL interview. Do you remember the first NFL player you ever interviewed?
I remember the first, let's see. I remember going to a Raiders practice to a training camp session in 1990 and mm-hmm. Talking to, because they had a joint training camp with the Cowboys, and talking to Michael Irvin. And and I was blown away. I mean, any kind of interaction with these guys was amazing to me. And then I would say some of my earliest memories of being an NFL beat writer was going into the Chargers locker room when they had played the Raiders, and looking at these guys and thinking, they look so young. Here these guys are that are, and that's the thing that blew me away. Even some of the star players had just had a little chin growth of whiskers, you know? I mean,
that was
thought, here's this guy making $5 million a year, and he's a phenomenal athlete, and he looks like a kid. And so I do remember early interviews. I just can't remember my very first interview. So
you did obviously cover John Gruden in that first 5 years with the Raiders. What was John Gruden like then and now? Different or the same, just in different eras?
He's been pretty consistent. I liked John. He's sort of frozen in time. I liked him when he came to the Raiders. He was very, approachable. He was a cartoonish almost in his enthusiasm and his voice, everything. And we sort of struck up a professional friendship, I would say, and that has grown over the years. And I got to know his parents very early on. I did some larger feature stories on John. Mm. I remember very early, my son was born in 1999, so this would have been John's second year as coach. And his mom sent me a bunch of clothes, sort of randomly, for our son, which was unusual, to say the least. And I said, John, your mom sent me some baby outfits for Thomas. And John said, let me see them. And he said, yeah, my mom made those. And I thought she made it was very, very surprising and charming, disarming to have his mom make those things. But John and I have had a lot of laughs over the years. I went to Gruden's quarterback camp one year. I told John I really wanted to come down there and sit in with him on that. And it happened to be the day that Andrew Luck came in. And so we had dinner with Andrew Luck that night. And it was actually just a small group. It was Andrew's uncle, who's his agent.
Will.
And, and John and Mark Ortega, John's right-hand man, and the ESPN crew. So we had dinner that night, and it was kind of funny because we ate in a steakhouse in Tampa, and everyone recognized Gruden. I mean, he was a rock star, even though, you know, he had won Tampa's only Super Bowl. Yeah. Nobody recognized Andrew Luck. I mean, Andrew Luck could have walked through the crowd without anybody saying anything. And
Andrew would like it that way, though. I've spent a lot of time with Andrew. He's quite happy that way.
Yes, absolutely. And he's obviously went to the American School there in London. And as we were leaving, we all piled into a van to head to our hotels. This is Saturday night before the day we spent together Sunday. And some girls came up to the van and knocked on the window, and they said, can we get a picture with Andrew? And he sheepishly agreed and got out of the van, and he got back into the van, and we were kind of ribbing him about it. And he said, I said, has that ever happened at Stanford? And he said, yeah, but it's usually three drunk guys.
That's a little bit different.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, John was great. John was a lot of fun, has been a lot of fun to cover.
So the stories Sam mentions there are the lifeblood of being a journalist, as we are fortunate to get behind the scenes and see another side of the characters who make the NFL what it is. Sam has been posted on his fair share of exciting assignments in the past. He's climbed Mount Rainier with Commissioner Roger Goodell. He spent time with Pete Carroll and the Seattle Seahawks for a week as they prepared for a game. Sam even piloted the Goodyear blimp and watched games with the great John Madden. He's got these opportunities from building trust with those around him, which is something he says remains the crucial aspect of his work today.
It's all based on trust. And that's eroded over the years in our industry. People trust, have sort of a lack of trust and are immediate suspicion. So I feel very fortunate to have built up relationships, because it's all based on relationships. And listen, you know, I don't love writing about sports as much as I love writing about people who play sports or coach sports, or, you know, it's the interaction with people. Yeah. And so people have to feel like they can trust you. Now, does that mean you paper over everything? No. But it means that you develop a relationship where people know sort of where you're coming from. I mean, whether it was, you know, like you said, the Mount Rainier experience, or going to Israel with 18 Hall of Famers, spending a week in Israel with guys like Jim Brown and Mike Singletary and Roger Staubach and Joe Montana and Eric Dickerson. That was an incredible trip, or those times with John Madden. You have to be honest and true to yourself and have integrity, of course, but you also have to treat very delicately these relationships that you have, because once you ruin one of those relationships by betraying a trust, word spreads very quickly, and there are going to be a lot of doors slamming in your face.
So. Well, especially, Sam, in those sort of circumstances, and I'm sure it's pretty similar, but obviously if you go to Israel with 18 Hall of Famers, you're not, you know, they probably don't feel like they're on the clock the whole time. So you have to sift out which bits you report, which bits you don't when you're sitting on the bus. I go around the country here in the UK doing the stage shows with the NFL players. You know, I'm sitting on a bus with Ryan Fitzpatrick, and he's talking about quarterbacks that he played with in New York. He's telling me stuff that I know he's not going to tell me if I interview him. So it's balancing what bits you use, right? Because you're with them it all is. The time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, obviously, and you maintain that integrity. So sometimes you might have to circle back and say, listen, you told me something, and whether it's me finding it out a different way or us circling back on the record and saying something, now is the time I've got to write something. And maybe it's not a critique of a quarterback, but it's something with gravitas that you have to do. And people respect that. I just think you have to be an honest broker on that stuff, because you're at the end of the day, your integrity is all you have. And that's your stock and trade is so people begin to, you always have to maintain, I think, that membrane where there's a professional relationship. These are not your best friends.
Right.
You're still going to have to write about them if something bad happens in their life that they're not going to want out there. I mean, you still have to maintain that professionalism and integrity. And yet, you can't, it seems to me there was sort of a shift in the business where people started thinking, I've got to hit a home run with every story. And,
right.
You know, integrity be damned. And if I have to burn them here, I'll burn them. But my name will get out there very quickly, and I'll ascend very quickly in the business. And I think those people find that that's a cul-de-sac. That's a career cul-de-sac, because suddenly people are completely blocking you out.
Right. Because they don't trust you. It's like a firework that goes off in a blaze of glory, but it'll die out pretty quickly.
Exactly. Yeah, that's no question.
Which of those kind of stories, those on assignments, there must be some where you're just like, this was just really cool, you know, and the fan in me who snuck into the Super Bowl in Pasadena, you know, would have loved this. And which of those kind of stories stick with you now when you look back?
Well, you know, there are so many, but, you know, just look at the Israel trip you know, so many funny stories and getting to know these guys and the Hall of Fame veneer. I mean, these were not just Hall of Famers. These were the creme de la creme of Hall of Famers.
Right.
Whether it was, you know, Jerome Bettis you know, Marshall Faulk or Chris Carter or
right.
Lem Barney. Anyway, I remember we were leaving our hotel in Tel Aviv, the Hilton there, to head up to the northern part of the country. And it was a crowded elevator, and we all have lanyards with our names on them. And Joe Montana and Roger Staubach are coming up in the elevator together. And there's a fan on the elevator, an NFL fan, who's just apoplectic, you know. Joe gets off on a lower floor and the guy's just stammering, and he says, do you know who that is? That's one of the greatest football players in NFL history. And at this point he said that's Joe Montana. He turns, he's telling the story to Roger Staubach. And Roger, like he's an insurance who's got this salesman. Great, yeah, he's got this great sense of humor. Roger says, really? Who'd he play for? And the guy says, he played for the 49ers. Then he glances down and has this epiphany, sees the lanyard that Roger's wearing. He says, "Hey, I know you." He says, "You're that real estate guy."
Oh.
So he had no idea that Roger Staubach was one of the greatest quarterbacks in NFL history, too.
Only that
he had built this real estate empire. And Roger said, "You know, that was one of the greatest moments." I mean, I remember I was out there in the Dead Sea with Joe and Jennifer Montana and their boys, Nate and Nick. And we had floated. Obviously, it's all about floating in the Dead Sea because of the salinity. Mm-hmm. And we had floated as a group sort of beyond these buoys. And just sort of relaxing out there and chatting, nice warm day. And NFL Films, which was on the trip, starts, you know, the cameramen rolled up their pants and start heading out toward us with the cameras engaged. And I thought, I'm not getting on NFL Films. I'm out here with a bunch of Hall of Fame players.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I keep in reasonable shape, but I'm not an NFL player. Yeah. So I said, I start swimming. I said, "Guys, I'm leaving." So I start swimming way outside the arc of the camera. Well, there's a crust on the bottom of the Dead Sea of salt. And, you know, so I don't want to put my feet down. So I'm drifting in closer and closer to the shore. And now I'm in like what feels like about 6 inches of water. And crawling up onto a dock. Now I look like the creature from the Black Lagoon crawling up on this dock. And I start walking up the dock and I see a woman. It looks like an American tourist in her 70s, sort of point in my direction and then pantomime as if she has a camera. And I kind of glance behind me. She can't be talking to me. So I continue to walk up the dock and I just look like the creature from the Black Lagoon. And she points to me again. I said, "Me?" And she said, "Yes, can I take your picture?" And I said, "Well, of course not." What are you thinking? No. And she said, "Well, you're Joe Montana, aren't you?"
I imagine the disappointment.
Yeah, I said, "You have the worst impression of a Hall of Fame quarterback." I said, "No, I'm not." But I think she saw somebody probably said, "Oh, the gray-haired guy out there is Joe Montana," because we were floating next to each other. She just thought she just picked the wrong Joe Montana. So for the rest of the trip, whenever we'd have roll call, as we'd get on our two buses that we traveled in, you know, they'd say Joe Montana, and everyone would point to me and say, "He's here."
We'll be back with more from Sam Farmer after this short break on the Neil Reynolds podcast.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds podcast.
Welcome back to the Neil Reynolds podcast and my conversation with LA Times reporter Sam Farmer. Now, before the break, we heard about Sam's exciting career covering the NFL and his claim to fame being mistaken once for the great Joe Montana. In some form, I've been mistaken for being the UK's Sam Farmer, and I'll explain. So Sam joined the LA Times in 2000 when there was no NFL team in the city. And every year at the commissioner's press conference ahead of the Super Bowl, Sam would ask about a team ever returning to the City of Angels. For me, at those same press conferences, I would ask the same question about a franchise coming to London, to which my colleagues in the British press would poke fun at, labelling me the British Sam Farmer. But while the appetite grows in the UK for an NFL franchise to relocate here, Sam now has two teams on his doorstep in the Chargers and the Rams.
Yeah, I really thought that it might never come because LA was such an effective stalking horse in this whole process, effective at getting stadiums done in other cities because LA was the cudgel that the league could hold over other cities to get public money. But it put me
Did you word it different every year?
I did. And, you know, one year I didn't ask it. And Roger came back to me and said, I had an answer for you. Why didn't you ask it? And so then it was just incumbent on me to ask it every year. And it became a joke. And my capstone, if you remember, my capstone question, once the Rams and Chargers were returning to L.A., my capstone will Los Angeles ever stop getting teams?
Yes.
but it was fun. It set me apart from the beat writers, and I had to learn the league and get to and build relationships on a different level than when I was a beat writer. When I was a beat writer, it was so important to have relationships with the players, not only first string players, but all the way down to, I always made sure I was close with the third string quarterback because that was the closest to a mortal on the team. You know, it was the guy who was in every meeting but had sort of a foot in both worlds because it was also so anyway. As
he knew it wasn't going to be there that long.
Yeah, exactly. As a beat writer, you had to be close with the players, and you had to be coach the players and the personnel and the coaches on a particular team. I had to know the owners. I had to deal with the owners, and I had to know the league staff, and I had to know the commissioner. Because for me, it was all about the moving chess pieces. Just as is the case with London. I mean, which way are the winds blowing, and sort of observing it at more of a 10,000 foot view than down on the ground with the granular and incremental machinations of a team.
London might be the new LA. We might be used the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. Well, some question, because there are more hurdles to overcome with London, but it's such a fantastic market, and the passion for the NFL is so great there because NFL fans in London have to work harder to root for their teams because they have to really seek out information, and it's a little bit like Premier League fans in the U.S. They tend to be better educated than most every fan out there because they're so passionate about it.
Yeah.
So invested. And that's how I find London fans are. They don't, it's not like the old days of international games where they cheered punts because somebody kicked the ball really high.
Right. No, they're sophisticated. They're very, they really
very
are.
Sophisticated. And that's, and the league loves that. And, you know, there are, you know, stadium options there, et cetera. So, that'll be interesting to see.
Talking of stadiums, SoFi Stadium. It's incredible, isn't it? I've never been in it, but it looks incredible.
You know, it is amazing. And I was speaking to a colleague today, and I said, you know, this is sort of like, and we were talking about how low slung the building is, and then the field is 100 feet below surface level. And, you know, it's very stylish, as you've seen, and swooping lines. It looks like the Disney Hall or Frank Gehry creation. But the amazing thing is when you get inside, how vast it is, just cavernous, this massive, because it goes down. And I said, you know, it's a little bit antithetical to Los Angeles. I said, because it doesn't try to wow you on the outside, and that you go in and it's very deep. And I said, that's exactly the opposite of LA.
That is a very good description.
Yeah. I said, you know, it's a little bit like the opposite of a Hollywood set, you know.
Right.
The Hollywood set looks beautiful on the outside, and then there's nothing behind it. This is, although I will say SoFi is pretty cool looking on the outside too, but it sneaks up on you. I mean, you come up to the stadium and the low profile, it's not monolithic like the, you know, you roll into Indianapolis and Lucas Oil Stadium is just dominant on the skyline. It looks impossibly large. outsized. SoFi sort of sneaks up on you, and you're like, and you think that's a cool looking building. Then you go inside, and it's stunning, and it has this Oculus, this halo shaped video board, which is the largest in the world, and yet it's not. It's incredible and bright and vivid, but it's not overbearing. It does, you don't feel like you've got a 150-inch TV in your home. Yeah.
Right.
Yes, not exactly. I mean, Jacksonville's video board, for instance, you could see that from space.
Right. Yeah.
And it looks ridiculous. It's distracting. This one blends in better. And I'm really interested to see what they're able to do with that ETFE transparent roof, because they've got a puck system where they can light the roof in such a way, even though the pucks are, I believe, several feet apart. These are light pucks, like they look like hockey pucks that they can, they emit colored light. They can create a streaming TV effect. So you could actually stream the game on top of the stadium. Wow. And with the incoming planes, I don't know if I'd want my pilot watching the game.
No, yes, just concentrate on landing my plane.
As he's landing at LAX.
Literally, but stay in your lane.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I did say, I did make a proposal to the Rams, and I'm sure I probably wasn't the only one, but if you have you have lots of international flights coming in. If you had an Air France flight coming in and you knew when it was coming in, you could have a French ad running on the top of that stadium.
You know they're selling adverts on top of that thing. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Now, a journalist of Sam's experience has seen it all in sports, as we discovered with some of his anecdotes earlier in the podcast. But forgetting the glamour of mountain climbing with NFL dignitaries and tours to the Black Sea with Hall of Famers, Sam's also witnessed plenty on game days, including a fair few losing locker rooms. As a sports journalist, there isn't a worse place to be, or at least that's my opinion.
I will tell you, it surprised me early on in my career what I thought a losing locker room would be like and what it was like. Now, if you're talking a losing Super Bowl locker room, that's one thing. But a lot of times you realize that players are mercenaries to a degree. And, if it's an incredibly disappointing loss, it can be quiet. But other times, it's a little livelier than I thought it'd be after a loss, because they're moving on to the next week. And they did their job. I remember going in I won't embarrass him by saying this, but I'll say I was covering the Raiders against the Jets. And the Raiders were humiliated in this game, and it was at the old Giants Stadium, at the old Meadowlands. And the Raiders, it was a pathetic performance. And I was holding a stat sheet as I walked in, and a running back sort of furtively called me over to his locker. And his first question was, "How many yards I get?" And I thought, aren't you upset about this at all? And it's right. But he was fixated on how many yards he gained in the game. So
Sam. I think it's a little bit different in NFL Europe when they're 4,000 miles from home. They're on a 2-7 team, and you walk into the locker room and they've just lost again, and you don't get a great response from the players. And in 92, I went into the London Monarchs locker room because they had a guy, he died in a car crash, actually. Danny Lockett, his name was. He was a pass-rushing defensive end and outside linebacker. He thought he should have been the league MVP, and they gave it to Judd Garrett. And the Writers Association of the UK asked me to present the trophy to Judd Garrett in the losing locker room about 6 foot away from Danny Lockett, it did not go well. It was that's why I say I've always had problems in losing locker rooms.
Oh my gosh. I didn't realize Jed Garrett won that. That's great. That would be awkward. I remember one game, it was the second game of the 1997 season, Monday Night Football, the Chiefs, Elvis Gerback, Chiefs Raiders in Oakland. Elvis Gerback hit Andre Rison at the end of the game to win the game. And it was Joe Bugle's second game as coach. And Joe, first of all, we're on deadline. It's Monday night, and everybody has less than an hour, down to minutes, to write their game story and get their quotes. Joe locked the locker room and then opened up the back door and let the players out of the locker room.
Oh, no.
Sent Tim Brown out to cover for the team. Poor Tim Brown had to do all the talking, and Albert Lewis. And he allowed everybody else to go out, stream out of the locker room, which was terrible, and he was pilloried for that. It was the first first of 1,000 cuts, death by 1,000 cuts, I mean, in a 4-12 season. So,
Jeremy Shockey once climbed over a fence out of the back of, he walked out the back of the locker room at New Orleans Saints training camp. Remember they used to train in Millsaps College?
Yeah.
He sneaked out the back of the locker room, and then we were waiting outside. We were going to film by the side of the practice field. We saw him go out the back of the locker room, climb a fence, and then get completely stuck because there's nowhere to go. He had to climb back over the fence and then tell us he had a meeting and couldn't do the interview.
That is classic.
Missing out on interviews like that is a pet peeve of mine in the NFL, as is the opening night at the Super Bowl, where journalists will come in all sorts of fancy dress, including grown men wearing wedding dresses, interviewing each other about how funny they are to be dressed up in fancy dress. It gets my goat, that one. I've got others, including the photographer's scrum at the end of any Super Bowl. The field just gets completely taken over with hundreds of photographers, and I think it robs the players of their celebrations. Sam has some of his own.
You know, I don't like the questions that begin with talk about.
Oh, yeah. I can't be bothered to make up a question for you.
Yeah, exactly. You say, basically, a reporter saying, regale me with stories about this, or fill my notebook with that.
Right.
And that's not really a question that starts with talk about, and it happens quite a bit. I got to say, those things that you mentioned are pet peeves of mine, too. Although I also don't like people complaining, reporters complaining too much about situations. Like you'll hear a reporter or you'll read a reporter saying the food at the Super Bowl is terrible.
Yeah. Well, the free food.
Yeah, the free food that all those fans who are 99% of those fans will never see an NFL game, let alone a Super Bowl in person. People are not sympathetic to that. They don't want to hear that the parking was far from the stadium,
right?
Or that there weren't good enough parties. I'll tell you a funny party story. I was in Jacksonville for the Super Bowl one year, and Sports Illustrated had a party, and my dear and dearly departed friend Don Banks had an extra ticket, and so we were going to the Sports Illustrated party, and I think it was Kanye West was the entertainment at the time, and I had sort of a redundancy because a woman had called me, sort of associated with the party, had called me earlier in the week and said, do you want to come to this party? So I said, yes. And I accepted the ticket from Don. So Don and I arrive at the party, and it's a long line in Jacksonville. Felt like a mile long, and we're at the end of the line. And a woman speed walks toward the end of the line and says, Sam Farmer, what are you doing waiting in line? You have no business. You shouldn't wait in the line. You don't have to wait in line. And every head turns, you know, and I'm sort of acting like I don't like it, but I'm luxuriating in the fact that I'm getting singled out and pulled to the front of the line. So it was the woman from the party. She walks me right up to the front of the line and she says, okay, now you stand right here and interview the guests, the party guests as they come in.
Oh, said, that's what she wants. Said, oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I said, I'm not working this party.
No, I'll go back there. I'll go back to the back of the line, thanks.
I had to skulk back to the end of the line.
No, did you? Walk a shame.
No, to get my ticket. I wasn't going to work the party. I didn't. So now I make it clear whenever invited to a party,
yeah,
I said,
you need
you're not expecting me to work it, right? I'm going to the party. Yeah.
But, that's a great story.
Humiliating.
Obviously, you've seen thousands of snaps, thousands and thousands, big plays. This is a tough one. Whenever people ask that question, you know, you try and pick something out of your career. But on the field, is there a kind of wow moment? So I was just, again, an example. I was very fortunate. One year we hosted the Super Bowl from the sidelines for Sky Sports. I was on the goal line when Malcolm Butler jumped that route and intercepted Russell Wilson.
Wow.
And they said to me, yeah, they're coming. They said, we're coming to you in 10 seconds, Neil. And the first thing I said was, who the heck is Malcolm Butler? And I reached for the flip card, you know, because nobody really knew Malcolm Butler then. So
yeah,
is there a moment in a Super Bowl or a big game, you know, when you knew you were watching something historic and it was just like, wow.
So many. I've been so fortunate. But, you know, ones that jump to mind, that come to mind so quickly, would be Tim Tebow in a playoff game, Denver and Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And Tebow, who had this magical run and throws a touchdown pass that covers 80 yards after he hadn't completed anything. And that, I thought about that job. And I want to say it was the first overtime victory under the new rules.
Yeah.
So it was an 80-yard touchdown. I think about Eli Manning, you know, escaping and throwing the pass to David Tyree to beat the Patriots in that Super Bowl. You know, there are just so many. Think about the block going back to New Orleans, which was an incredible weekend, going back to New Orleans when they played Atlanta, which was the first game back in the Superdome after Katrina, and the block punt, which really just the loudest I've ever heard a stadium. That I remember that weekend because I got a call from a friend. I was working on a Sunday afternoon. That was a Monday night game. And all these preparations were going on at the Superdome. He called me and said, come down here. I said, well, I'm working right now. He said, no, get down here. So I came down, and there were about 100 people on the field in the Superdome milling about. And Bono walks right past me. And I was like, Bono? Is that Bono, or is that a Bono impersonator? It was Bono. And U2 and Green Day proceeded to have probably a 2-hour sound check mini concert for 100 of us.
Wow.
Which was just unbelievable. And I had a little paper. I don't know if you have a kid in second or third grade, but here they do something called Flat Stanley. And you take pictures of flats. It's a paper.
Oh, yes. Kit. Yeah, I know. Yep.
And you take pictures all over. So I had Bono up on stage, or Flat Stanley up on stage with Bono. And my kid's like, what's this? He had no idea. You know, I said, one day you're going to treasure this photo.
Yeah.
Flat Stanley and Bono.
So that's my interview with Sam Farmer. Just great stories. That's what I love about this sport, is it provides great stories. I hope you enjoy that. Even if it's not a player or a coach, I think Sam gives us that access that, you know, we just don't have as fans. So yeah, I hope you really enjoyed that. Let's answer a few questions then from the mailbag. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes. Gary, do you enjoy that with Sam?
I did. He came across as this like Jerry Maguire character who's been there and seen it all. And
that's because he has, I think.
Yeah, but as I was listening to it and recording it, I was getting lost in the stories. I was thinking, no, you know, you're working here. You've got to sort of focus. But some of the stories he was telling and the stuff in the Black Sea was just gold.
Yeah, it was really good. Really good stuff. So, yeah, appreciate Sam taking the time. What you got for us in the mailbag, Gary? We put out a call and our listeners have responded.
Well, they responded in their droves as well. I think they were mailbag hungry. So we had plenty, which we'll cross over to another week. But I've picked the top three for my choice anyway. So this one's actually topical because Rob, who sent it in on Twitter, he's got no surname, so we just call him Rob. He must have heard this interview before because he starts asking about a London franchise. And obviously, Sam and yourself were talking about a London franchise. So he says, has COVID derailed any hope of an NFL franchise in the UK for the foreseeable future?
I don't think so. I think only in terms of, yeah, the same way it's delayed everything and upset timings of everything. The Euros getting pushed back, all of that kind of thing. You know, we didn't have any London games this year. I think if everything's okay from a travel point of view, from a safety point of view, we'll have at least four games again next year. And I think it'll be full steam ahead. I don't think we've lost momentum. I don't think the NFL's lost interest in the market. We have seen, I think, obviously games would have been played behind closed doors here in London, so there would be no little point bringing teams over to do that. But also we've seen how fragile the fixture list has been in the NFL this season and how things are changing late on and how games are getting postponed. It just shows it was the right decision not to bring teams over to play games here this year. But no, they'll be back, and they'll be back stronger than ever. So no, I have no worries on that front whatsoever. I still think we'll have four games per year for the foreseeable future, and I'm still confident that we could have a franchise.
I hope they do come back because I'm missing those NFL lunches on game day.
You do. There. Well, yeah, you do like to, you know, whenever I walk past the press room, you've got another hot dog in your hand.
Pile up on the carbs. Exactly. carb up. Right, so this is from Jake, who has half of a good surname, Jake Fenwick Hayes. I'll let you do the maths. He says, hey Neil, would love to hear any behind the scenes talk about the international series games, especially your thoughts on the best approach teams can take, i.e. fly on the wall, fly in for the week, or the more popular fly on the Friday. Keep up the great work. Loved the podcast so far. Thanks, Jake.
Oh, that's great, Jake. Thank you. Yeah. Two schools of thought: fly in early, get your work done in London, practice ground, and then play the game, or come in really late, having done all your work in America. I obviously prefer the first one because I think it gives us a chance to do more with the teams, to get the teams more attention in the market. I think there's a growing trend towards teams wanting to stay in America, get that work done out there, and then fly in for the game. Couple of behind the scenes stories. So I'll just tell you one from, so last week I've been putting out these pictures every Thursday celebrating the London games. These are when we would normally be doing the London games. And I put a picture on of myself. It was the first big event I hosted for NFL UK. It was the 2010 fan rally in Trafalgar Square. It was absolutely packed. It was about 10,000-15,000 people in, all queuing outside, and you could only let a certain amount into the square at a time. And it was ahead of the 49ers and Broncos game. And the 49ers were having a bad year. And their head coach, let me put it this way. He wasn't really winning over the team. Mike Singletary was a great player, a Hall of Fame defender for the Chicago Bears. He wasn't a great head coach, including one time when his team was getting really badly beaten at halftime. And he pulled his trousers down and addressed the team with his trousers around his ankles because he thought it was going to show how they were being embarrassed. Anyway, coaches come to the fan rallies with a very, very limited amount of free time. They want to get there, get on stage, wave, answer a few questions from me, and then get the hell out of there because they want to get back to preparing for the game the next day. So Mike Singletary rocks up with about seven or eight players, a couple of assistant coaches, and he starts to walk up the ramp backstage that goes straight onto the stage. And we're like, no, coach, you got to wait. We got a run of show. We got another thing before you're on. We just needed to get you here a few minutes early. No, I want to get on. Let's go. Walks up onto the stage, realizes that there's a huge drum line. You know the big drum lines with about 20 drummers?
Right.
The drum line are on stage already. So Mike Singletary, who's got all his players to come up behind him, but even though we tried to stop him, has to then hide behind the white drapes that have the International Series logo on it. He's behind there while they're drumming the you-know-what out of their drums for like 5 or 10 minutes. He was fuming. He's got his hands over his ears and he's like, literally, I'm being deafened. I was like, well, no one told you to come up here. You could have stayed backstage where we told you to stay, and this is the result. And he had to stand there the whole time, and then I had to go on and introduce him, and he kind of just came from behind the curtain.
Like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, exactly. But hey, you do what you should have. You should have just done what you were told.
So when you interviewed him, could he hear you properly as well? His eardrums must have been blown out.
Oh, he wasn't really listening anyway. He was just answering as quick as he could and got out of there. He had a phrase. There was a great, well, part of this, there was a famous NFL films clip where he was mic'd up, and when he played, he had the really wide eyes, wild eyes. And there was a famous clip, and it was really famous, where he was making big hit after big hit, and he got up and he was like, I like this kind of party. And so he came on stage and I went, Coach, do you like this kind of party? Like, you know, try to play on that. He had no idea what I was on about. He's like, well, I've only just got here, but it looks like everyone's having a good time. I was like, oh, okay, let's just get this.
He did all that prep and he didn't even appreciate it.
Honestly, don't know why I bother.
Right, last question. And you can't answer this like you're a coach and got to get out of here quick, because I think this needs, actually, this could be a podcast episode. From Elliot, again, no surname. What is your most memorable moment whilst visiting training camps?
Wow. That could be a podcast. And actually, I think we should make that a podcast one day.
Could be a series.
Yeah, it could be. And I think it should be in the future. Stay tuned. So it's never really about the field, the stuff on the field for me, because sometimes you can turn up somewhere and teams will kind of just go through the motions. It'd be a quiet day of practice, or they'll be full on scrimmaging, tackling to the ground. And it's like you're watching a game and you're literally sat or kneeling down on the sidelines right where the action is. For me, it's always about the kind of travel log stuff, and because people sort of laugh about my journey, but I try and cut down the amount of time I'm there. So if I'm going to see 8 teams, I'll see them in 8 straight days. So literally get up, go to practice, watch practice, do all your interviews, run to the airport or drive to the next place. So there's a few. One time I was driving from New York down to Baltimore, and I like to drive wherever I can rather than messing about with airplanes.
See the open road.
Yeah, and also the 7th day in a row of going through airport security and taking your shoes off and your belt off is a bit of a drag. So if you can drive some of them, you do. I was driving from New York to Baltimore, and it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a summer's day. And all of a sudden, it just went biblical. It went like night, like proper nighttime, like not even like a little bit gloomy, but like proper nighttime. And there's forked lightning in every direction, in front of the car, to the side of the car, to the right side of the car. We were driving about 10 miles an hour. The rain's coming down. And it was one of those where it was a proper white knuckle ride. My knuckles were white. I got to the hotel and I was like, just had to sit in the car for a sec. I was like shaking. And I put the news on. I got into the hotel room, put the news on, and they said Baltimore had 10,000 lightning strikes in an hour.
Wow.
I was driving through it just to get to the Ravens training camp. There was another time, I won't go into all the travel ones, but these just remind me. I'd been with the Bengals, so 2016, been at training camp with the Bengals, and we were flying to Minneapolis to see the Vikings the next day. And it was one of those planes. I don't know if you've been on them in America, the internal flights, where they've got 2 seats on one side and just 1 seat down the other side.
I flew on one of them last year from New York to Canada. Horrible.
The little twin propellers, and I can't stand up straight in them, which freaks me out already. It makes me a bit claustrophobic. So anyway, I crawl onto the plane, you know, get into my seat, and we take off, and the pilot says, we may get a little bit of turbulence. We're going to leave our seatbelts on for a little while. But we'll just see if we can ride it out. And I'm looking out of the window, my right-hand side of the window, and it's beautiful. The sun is setting. It's the end of a beautiful summer's day. The weather looks perfect. And I'm like, I don't know what the pilot's going on about. And I'm in one of the two seats on the right-hand side of the plane. And I'm with Jamie King, who runs all of the social media channels and content for NFL UK. And he's sitting on the left-hand side of the plane. And he just taps me on the arm. And he's like, look at that. It was a rolling, broiling, black wall of death. It was horrible-looking clouds, storms. You could see the lightning in it. And he said, don't worry too much about it. We'll be all right as long as we don't bear left. Within seconds, must have been 2 seconds of him saying that, the plane tilts to the left, steers, and then we're just heading for this cloud. Honestly, it was one of those, you know, you try and read your book and ride out the turbulence. It was one of those, people are screaming. I've got hold of both arms of the chair. I can't even read. It was like a roller coaster.
You and Jamie should have had a cuddle to comfort each other.
Well, I'm gonna out Jamie here because he told me the next morning. He said, I got to my hotel. I was so stressed. I had to have a bath, a cup of coffee, and watched an episode of Towie in the bath.
Towie?
Apparently.
Towie.
Honestly, that was the life flash before my eyes. I'd never been so happy to get, I almost did the whole kind of, you know, when the Pope used to arrive somewhere and get on the floor and kiss the ground. That was an adventure, that one.
I'm just disturbed by Jamie. Forget your turbulence. Jamie going, I just needed to watch an episode of Towie.
Well, apparently that's how you unwind in the high-powered NFL that is today. He's going to kill me for saying that.
I'm not impressed.
So there you go.
In saying that, from being not impressed, I was impressed by an interview that we've just done, which is going to be the one next up for us next week.
Yes, so this is a little bit different. It's not a current NFL player, coach, or journalist. It's a man who's given so much of his life to American football in the UK. So it's a part of kind of Black History Month, and Gerry Anderson is being recognised as a pioneer in the British game. He grew up as an NFL fan. He was an amateur player for the London Olympians. He played for the London Monarchs professionally in NFL Europe. He went into coaching. He now works on football operations for NFL UK, does all the London games, and he's a mentor for the young kids who are in the NFL Academy. So I just thought Gerry needed to be recognised in this of all months. So he's up next. So yeah, looking forward to that one.
Me too.
All right. Good stuff, Gary. Thank you for all your efforts. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next week. Bye for now. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.